The final phase of the Synod on Synodality kicked off this week, and the topic of female ordination is or is not on the agenda. The world over's Synod Central resumes with the papal posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal. And actor-producer Jonathan Rumi talks with me about his new documentary, Heart of a Servant, The Father Flanagan Story. And an encore of my interview with comedian, author, and free speech advocate Rob Schneider about his wonderful new memoir, You Can Do It. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. What a show we have for you. If you'd like to comment on it, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram. Lots to cover. Before we dive in, a quick primer for those joining us late in the game. This week began the final act of the multi-year synod process, a meeting of bishops and the Pope that began back in 2015. An initiative of Pope Francis, the synods were billed as a kind of Vatican III and hailed by progressives as a chance to redefine church practice and teaching. But it really hasn't accomplished much or anything. The Synod on the Family was supposed to change church teaching on divorce and remarried Catholics, but there was fierce resistance by cardinals, bishops, the laity. The battle was so ugly, the Pope had to settle for a footnote in a document cooked up by a committee. Learning their lesson, organizers tried to limit the guest list at the 2019 Amazonian Synod and keep out the naysayers. But due to the appearance of the Pope praying before a Pachamama idol and a timely book release by Cardinal Sarah and Benedict XVI, the effort to toss out clerical celibacy was averted. Along the way, there were papal edicts limiting the Latin Mass and authorizing the blessing of gay couples, none of which was discussed or voted on in these synods. Now we have the last synod, allegedly, populated by largely progressives and stage-managed within an inch of its life. They want no floor fights, and the agenda is murky, given that most of the hot-button issues have now been sent to study committees handpicked by the Pope, which begs the question— why go through this theatrical parliamentary exercise at all, especially when the Pope will do as he pleases anyhow? And how can you listen to the whole church when only one voice of the church is allowed access to the synodal hall? With that, let's go to Synod Central, where we bring you the latest from this month-long synod on synodality in Rome. Joining me, the papal posse, editor-in-chief of the CatholicThing.org, Robert Royal from Rome, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray, joining me from Manhattan. Gentlemen, here we go again. Before the synod officially began on Wednesday, Pope Francis presided at what was called a penitential celebration. In this liturgy, Pope Francis had seven cardinals read requests for forgiveness for seven sins identified by the Secretary General of this Synod. And apparently these requests were written by the Pope himself. Cardinal Christoph Schönborn of Austria asked forgiveness in the name of all the baptized for sins against synodality and listening.
I ask forgiveness, feeling shame for the obstacles that we place in the building of a truly synodal symphonic church. Aware of being holy people of God who walk together, recognizing the common baptismal dignity. I ask forgiveness, feeling shame for all the times that we have not heard the Holy Spirit, preferring to listen to ourselves, defending opinions and ideologies that hurt the communion in Christ of all, expected at the end of time from the Father. I ask forgiveness, feeling shame for when we have transformed authority into power, suffocating plurality.
Father, is there really a sin against synodality? And what do you make of this opening ceremony?
Well, I've never heard of a sin against synodality, and really, synodality now is a completely vague term. We don't know what it means. Originally, synod meant a meeting of bishops. In the Catholic Church, that was its ecclesiastical definition. Now it's become a meeting of everybody all lay people, priests, deacons, bishops, cardinals, the Pope. It is like you mentioned the word parliament. It's this expression of kind of aping what is done in the secular world, and it bears, really kind of a resemblance more to a popular assembly, which is not elected but appointed by a strong man. We had the popular assembly in Venezuela. What is going on here? A meeting of bishops to tell the Pope, advise the Pope, has become now a potpourri of everybody with grievances and agendas. And the idea that you sin against synodality by disagreeing, isn't synodality meant that we listen to each other, including when we disagree?
Yeah, Bob, what does it mean to have a sin against plurality? One could argue, I won't, but one might, that when the Pope issued that, a blessing on gay couples, that was a sin against plurality. There was no plurality in the church that wanted that.
Yeah, it's ironic that Cardinal Schönborn, who is the primary author of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, an invaluable document stating what we believe and what we believe ought to be our morals, apologized for turning authority into power. I think that without authority, without proper authority from God, what is the church other than a debating society? When we receive a revelation from God, someone has to interpret that, and that has to be an authority. Now, what we've seen, and you rightly say, is that that authority has been turned into power and has created an obstacle for some people, like the traditional Latin Mass. People were not harming anyone. They're no longer basically allowed to celebrate the Latin Mass. There are people who've been insulted as being rigid and being backwardist. And yet, at the same time, we're told that this is supposed to be a conversation that gets us beyond our own views of the world and gets us into a listening dialogue with one another. So it's clearly a contradiction in terms. And the real oddity about it all is, I think, anyway, that synodality is not a what. It's a process. And we've been told by some of the synod organizers that the synod is what it does, which means it can do just about anything.
Okay, reading one of the prepared petitions for forgiveness was the head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez. And he was begging pardon for the supposed misuse of doctrine, expressing the following.
Shame for all the times that in the church, especially us pastors who are entrusted with the task of confirming our brothers and sisters in the faith, have not been able to guard and propose the gospel as a living source of eternal newness, indoctrinating it and risking reducing it to a pile of dead stones to be thrown at others.
Bob, the sin of using doctrine as stones to be hurled, your reaction quickly.
Look, I think it's exactly the opposite. If you want to look at a sin that certain members of the clergy have committed, it's not defending doctrine. I mean, how many people are throwing doctrinal stones at other people? It's a small group. It's like the Pharisees. The number of people who ignore Catholic doctrine and think that they can change is immensely larger. So, look, I understand what they think that they were trying to do with it, but it seems to me that the exact opposite is the reality.
Yeah, Father, it sounds like restating and defending established church doctrine is now a sin. So what's the purpose of doctrine at all then?
No, this is, I'll say it quite good. This is a ridiculous and contemptible idea that telling someone the truth of Christ as taught by his church is somehow an attack, if not an attempt to kill that person. Because remember, stoning is a means of killing people. So throwing stones by telling them the truth, defending the Trinity, the Incarnation, the real presence. I think this goes back to the moral order. When you tell people not to commit sin that they like to commit, they feel offended. They're not offended. They're being liberated from their error by being told that their behavior doesn't conform to God's law. So this really is horrible for the head of the doctrinal office to say teaching doctrine is an offense against people. It's not.
Father, there were a string of cardinals. I can't go through them all. We just don't have time. But Cardinal Kevin Farrell of the Dicastery for Laity, Family, and Life read Pope Francis's prayer for forgiveness on behalf of all the men in the church for the times that the dignity of women has not been recognized or defended. He said, on behalf of all members of the church, especially us men, acknowledging the certain contempt for the dignity of women and making them, quote, silent and submissive. Father, what do you make of these newly coined sins? And who in the church made women silent and submissive? And why didn't anyone tell Mother Angelica or Nancy Pelosi?
This is a ridiculous caving in to feminist categories, which basically say since men are in charge, women are oppressed. This is absolute nonsense. The highest saint in the church is the Blessed Virgin Mary. The female saints throughout history, among the most inspiring leaders that we have on the path to heaven. I work as a parish priest. I don't know, 75, 80% of the people I cooperate with on a daily basis are women. What this is getting at is to say to the feminists who want to have female ordination, I'm sorry we offended you. Please forgive us. This is ridiculous. You want to defend women? How about we teach the truth about marriage? How about we teach the truth about abortion? And I praise Pope Francis because he's been teaching that truth recently with great vigor on the airplane. Mm-hmm. But telling women that they're oppressed by a male church, this is nonsense. This is not the truth.
Bob, what do you make of this entire penitential service? Again, it sounds like it could have come from a UN website or something.
Yeah, I mean, as we can see quite clearly, it apologizes for a lot of sins that are kind of a progressive nature, a kind of a liberalizing nature in the church that fit quite well with what goes on in the developed world, in Europe and in the United States and in other developed countries. Meanwhile, around the world, when things like the blessing of gay couples is proposed by the Vatican, we get an enormous pushback in Africa, in Asia, in Eastern Europe, among the Christian Orthodox, and for many others as well. So there are many other voices out there, and why those particular sins were selected as opposed to others, you can only put it down to a kind of a politicizing element in this penitence right before you begin a big event like the Synod.
Jens, at the start of this Synod on October 2nd, Pope Francis defended the changes to the Synod that now allow participation of non-bishops as full members. He said the following: the bishop, the principal and visible foundation of unity of each particular church, cannot carry out his ministry except within the people of God and with the people of God, preceding, standing in the midst of, and following that portion of God's people entrusted to his care. Father, your thoughts on this, and why call it a synod of bishops if this is the, quote, new way with the people leading the shepherd?
Well, this has been a problem since the Pope decided that we were going to have lay people and priests and deacons and women and men religious as equal voting members of a synod. The Synod of Bishops was started after Vatican II by Pope Paul VI, precisely so that representative bishops from throughout the world could advise the Pope, because the bishops, according to Vatican II, share a common concern for the entire church. Now this has become basically what Bob used the word debating society. Everyone's in on the act. Everybody gets to talk. But by the way, they're selected people. Why is a bishop important in a diocese? Because he is a successor of the apostles who is responsible for that flock. So therefore, to say, well, the bishop is equal to the layperson at a synod is to undermine the order of the church. The bishops are ordained ministers of Christ, and they're hierarchs, meaning they have authority to guide the sheep. That is being neglected. In fact, it's really been eviscerated at this synod because, you know, a college student has an equal vote to a cardinal in charge of a Roman curia, of a Roman dicastery. This is not how the church works.
Yeah. Well, my concern is, and you heard it in that definition, the bishop is a symbol of unity. He's not a symbol of unity. He's the shepherd of souls. And you know, Bob, your reaction to this quickly, before we talk about, well, I'll get your reaction to this as well. Cardinal Mueller, Gerhard Mueller, weighed in on the canonical issues with this synod. Given the preponderance of non-bishop participants and voting members, he said it is not a homogeneous assembly, and therefore the canonical status of the assembly is not clear. It cannot be that all are giving counsel and speaking together, and the Pope remains as the only authority who decides according to his own parameters and not according to the revelation, the revealed truth. This is the wrong perspective. Bob, your take first and then Father.
Yeah, I'd like to hear the canon lawyers speak about this one. But just as a layman, let me say this. This business reminds me of a joke. It actually happened, though, that someone asked Cardinal Newman once, does the church need lay people? And he said she would look awfully foolish without them. Now, if you took this just at a superficial level, of course it's true that bishops need to be working alongside lay people. That's what he's there for. A shepherd must have sheep. But I don't think that that's what was intended here. And what I fear is that under this sort of high-sounding way of democratizing what the shepherd and the sheep are really about, it's really about increasing the power of lay people in the church in ways that are unspecified. And I think Cardinal Mueller is exactly right, therefore puts into question what is the status of a bishop. A bishop is either the shepherd who watches over the sheep, or he's just a larger sheep or a central sheep walking along with the rest of the flock.
Father, you're the canonist of the group here. Cardinal Mueller questions the canonical status of this entire synod, given how differently it's being conducted from synods previous. Your thoughts?
Yes, well, Cardinal Mueller is right if you talk about theology and canon law reflecting theology. The reason why the Synod of Bishops was started after Vatican II was to give the shepherds of the church throughout the world a role in advising the Pope, who is the universal shepherd, but he depends on good advice and guidance. And that is given in their role as shepherds with and under the Pope. So the idea that the leadership of the church is now going to include in some strange way in these solemn deliberations people who aren't shepherds, who aren't bishops, it undermines the unique nature of the episcopate in the church. This is really, it's a serious problem. Cardinal Burke spoke about this a year ago. This is a very serious problem. We are not like the Anglican Church, where the leadership can decide, well, lay people and priests and bishops, everybody has an equal role at a synod. No, this is really a violation of what Vatican II intended with the Synod of Bishops.
Bob, as we've been reporting for months, LGBT issues, the ordination of women, those have all been slated for discussion in private study groups set to meet all the way through June of 2025. Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez did offer this update on the women's ordination issue. Based on the analysis conducted so far, he says, which also takes into account the work done by the two commissions established by Pope Francis on the female diaconate, the dicastery judges that there is still no room for a positive decision by the magisterium regarding the access of women to the diaconate, understood as a degree of the sacrament of holy orders. The Holy Father himself recently confirmed this consideration publicly. In any event, the dicastery judges that the opportunity to continue the work of in-depth study remains open. Bob, so this comes from the secret study group on this issue. Fernandez acknowledges that the Pope's position, the fact that he shut down the possibility of a female diaconate with holy orders, as he told Nora O'Donnell back in May on 60 Minutes, yet the DDF judges that the study may continue. Why? What are they studying?
Well, it seems clear to me, although I may be overly optimistic, that Francis has decided that there will be no female deacons in the Catholic Church. Now, he said that often. I think that he keeps open the so-called study because it prolongs the moment of having to make a decision. But I think pretty much his mind is made up about this. What I'm worried about is that there will be a kind of an incremental approach from a different angle, and that is there will be some sort of para-ministry that will, in effect, mirror being a deacon. But it won't be called being a deacon. It'll be some sort of female order of some kind that will, you know, sort of through salami tactics get us closer and closer to allegedly being able to ordain women. I don't think that this Pope will go in that direction. He's headed in that direction, and he's left that conversation open. But it's very odd. You say that word still, it still seems impossible to pronounce in a affirmative way about deaconesses. It means that they're going to continue to discuss as long as they can and not make a decision.
Yeah, Father, I mean, Will the DDF, the Doctrinal Office of the Vatican, eventually overrule the Pope? Are we seeing the development in real time of some kind of non-ordained diaconate for women?
Well, that's the worrying thing here, Raymond. When he says, Cardinal Fernandez says, the diaconate understood as part of holy orders. No, wait a minute. Diaconate is part of holy orders. This isn't somebody's understanding. You know, you and I can understand a historical event differently. We can understand a sacrament differently because it has one nature. So it's very worrying. I think Bob's right on target here. I think they want to try and probably resurrect deaconesses, which are definitely was an institution in the early church, but had nothing to do with being ordained as male deacons were ordained. So, no, it's very worrying. And this whole tentative notion that the DDF, you know, prolongs a study because we can't yet arrive at a decision in favor of what people are asking for. The Catholic Church does not exist as an opinion-gathering organization that finally says, okay, enough talk, now the decision. No. Revelation is given to the church. We know this. There have never been female deacons in the church for a reason, because Jesus didn't intend that, and the apostles understood that.
Yeah. I want to turn away from the synod for one moment before we return to it at the end. I have to ask you about a recent report that the Vatican is targeting traditional Latin Mass communities, and that now includes an apostolic visitation of the Priestly Society of St. Peter. This is an order of priests that celebrate the traditional Latin Mass in full communion with Rome. In a September 30th statement from the Vatican, the Dicastery for Institutes of Consecrated Life says the following. They've called for an apostolic visitation to the priestly fraternity of St. Peter in order to deepen the understanding of this society of apostolic life, of pontifical right, and to offer the most appropriate support for its journey of following Christ, end quote. Father, I'll let you take a swat at this first. Your thoughts on why this visitation is being called now? The statement sounds benign, but is it?
Well, originally, the fraternity was under the Ecclesia Dei Commission, which was part of the doctrine of the faith. It was transferred to the Congregation for Religious. So the Congregation for Religious is saying that we need our own information on how it's going. That's the public aspect that's being presented. But I'm worried because apostolic visitations have been used with other religious congregations and orders as a means of disciplining them, of changing things, of, you know, going after them. The Fraternity of St. Peter has many vocations. There's many requests all over the world for them to begin their apostolate. They're doing a great job, wonderful priests. Taken in line with Traditionis Custodes, what we have here is a continual surveillance mode on those people who like the Latin Mass. Where's the surveillance mode on religious orders which promote heresy and immorality? I haven't seen that.
Yeah. Bob, the Fraternity of St. Peter just had an apostolic visitation in 2014. And as we've reported many times, there are a plethora of different Eastern rites with different styles of liturgy within the Latin Church. There's the Ordinariate. There's the newly authorized three-year study of a new Amazonian rite liturgy in South America. So what is the problem here?
Yeah, and one of the sins that was confessed at that penitential rite is the sort of stifling of diversity for a kind of a unity. Look, you can't help but be nervous in seeing this happen. You know, it kind of reminds you of that old joke of Ronald Reagan's that the most terrifying phrase in the English language is, I'm from the U.S. government and I'm here to help. Well, you don't investigate a group like this after all the measures that have been taken against the Latin Mass without there being the expectation that maybe there's something more than just a authentic desire to help people be more authentic in their vocation to the Latin Mass. Now, I'm very worried about this too, and it seems to me to go right again against the principle of synodality, that we are a church that is able to have Eastern Rite and Melkite Rite churches. I don't see what the problem is with the Latin Rite with the FSSP.
Mm. Back in 2016, the Lepanto Institute conducted a study of political contributions from employees of church-run organizations, Catholic Relief Services principally, finding that 98% of those employees donated to pro-abortion candidates and causes. They've done a new analysis now, expanding this research to include other Catholic charitable organizations, including Catholic Charities, St. Vincent de Paul, and the Knights of Columbus, with new data showing overwhelming support, except for the Knights of Columbus, for pro-abortion, pro-LGBT candidates and causes coming from those ostensibly Catholic organizations. Father, your thoughts on these findings, perhaps not surprising, but what does it tell us about catechesis in the last half of this century?
Well, it tells me that these organizations, sadly, employ a lot of people who do not share the Catholic perspective on morality. And that is sad. How can you be promoting and working as a church organization to promote the truth of Christ, you know, that Christ loves the poor, the sick, and not include the unborn? Or how can you work for an organization which promotes the proposition that moral living is the only path to happiness, and yet they're voting for candidates who want to enshrine in law immoral behavior? It's very disappointing, and it's sad because, you know, except, as you say, the Knights of Columbus, apparently these organizations don't require that their employees share the mission statement of those organizations in beyond the sense of simply helping the poor, but to do it from the perspective of Christian charity.
Bob, they say follow the money. How might this explain the synodal agenda and the preoccupation with just these causes that some of these folks are supporting politically?
Yeah, I think a lot of them, like other political leaders who claim to be Catholic, have talked themselves into the position that, well, okay, there's nothing we can do about abortion. There are large majorities in the United States that are in favor of abortion in some form or other, and therefore we're going to vote to support the people who help the poor. Well, this reminds me of the story by the American Catholic author Flannery O'Connor called You Can't Be Any Poorer Than Dead. That if you are not going to protect human life at its earliest moment, from the moment of conception, what kind of view are you going to really have about poverty? I mean, a lot of these programs, as we well know, are getting large support from government appropriations. It's not to say that they're necessarily a puppet of the government, that there are cases in which the Catholic charities do need some support from the government to provide services. But you have to think that the kind of people who go into this kind of work and see that their revenue stream depends largely on Democrat appropriations, it has to affect them somewhat.
Okay. Father, we are only at the beginning of the second. Let me do this again. Father, we are only at the beginning of this second session of the Synod on Synodality. Say that fast five times, ladies and gentlemen. What do you both see happening in the weeks ahead? I'll start with you, Father, and then go to Bob, who's in Rome.
Yeah, I think we've already seen the seeds of dissatisfaction with this change in the Synod, where these expert study groups are now reporting to the Synod, and they're the real power center in what's going to happen. Cardinal Grech issued a letter stating that anybody is welcome to submit contributions to the different committees, these study groups, so that they can make their voice heard. I think the Synod people are realizing that instead of doing the talking, they're being talked to.
Bob, before we go, what are you seeing in Rome? And it seems there's a lot of mixed messaging. You got Cardinal Fernandez saying ordination's off the table, yet the Pope is meeting with these female ordination activists. There's a lot of confusion out here outside of Rome.
Yeah, I take it that one of the central things that's already happened this week is are a couple lines that the Pope had in his homily at the opening Mass the other day. And he kind of said, to kind of paraphrase what he said, look, you shouldn't arrive at this synod with the idea that certain things are to be preserved at all costs. Well, in Catholicism, we know that certain things are to be preserved at all costs. People have been martyred standing up for the faith in all times and all places. So, look, if we want to give him the benefit of the doubt, okay, what he means is don't come with your mind closed. But I think that the one really good thing that he said, and I think he's anticipating what's going to be happening over the next few weeks, is that you should also find a way to not present, not impose, is actually the word he used, not impose an agenda while you're here at the Synod. Now, I agree with this entirely. But who's likely to impose an agenda? Is it Father James Martin or is it Cardinal Mueller? I mean, we know which people are really trying to impose something on the group as a whole. I'm assuming that, you know, don't be bullheaded is the conservatives he's criticizing, and don't try to impose an agenda is the liberals. But I think that it's very clear that the conservatives generally, or the traditionalists generally, are open to listening about things that can be discussed without departing from the faith.
Gentlemen, we will leave it there. It's going to be a long month. For commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, you can go to thecatholicthing.org. Thank you, gentlemen. You know him as Jesus in the TV hit The Chosen, but he's also the narrator and executive producer of a terrific documentary, Heart of a Servant, the Father Flanagan story, in theaters for one night only on October 8th. Please welcome back to the program, Jonathan Rumi. Jonathan, thanks for being here. I want to talk for a moment about you narrating and executive producing this new documentary, Heart of a Servant. Tell me, the film brings Father Edward Flanagan's life to the screen, from his birth in Ireland to his years at Boys Town in the United States.
That's right.
Why is it important to share his story now?
You know, I think at a time when we are just immersed in so much darkness in the culture and just bad news everywhere you turn, this story is such a bright light in the culture. It's such a story of hope and faith and what people can do when they're led by the Holy Spirit to champion for the rights of the poor and the less fortunate in this world. And Father Flanagan was certainly a champion of those of the downtrodden, of the abandoned, specifically abandoned children, the early part of the 20th century. And he just essentially established a worldwide model for child welfare throughout the world.
Jonathan, as you mentioned, in October of 1921, Father Flanagan founded Boys Town in a cornfield in Omaha, Nebraska. He had more than 150 boys he was caring for. And he went on to save many children in Europe, in Asia, after World War II, at the request of Presidents Roosevelt and Truman. What impressed you about his work and life as you looked back on it?
Yeah, you know, the amount of energy that this man had was incredible to do and accomplish the things that he did, especially a man that started out very sickly from the time he was a baby. He was sickly throughout his whole life and just, you know, offered it up as he persisted to go after the rights of these kids and kids that were through the no fault of their own, through the depression, were being abandoned and orphaned by the dozens. And he literally became the face of Christ to these guys, these kids, and, you know, proved his own personal maxim that there was no such thing as a bad boy, and that essentially that, you know, children needed love and compassion and guidance and chores and things that would make them a productive member of society, that essentially gave, you know, the United States this crop of young men that otherwise would have ended up in jail and had successful lives. And, you know, I went to visit Boys Town not too long ago for the premiere of the film, and I met a number of people that were actually working at Boys Town, which still runs now and takes care of kids that need guidance, that need a little extra. I mean, it's not just boys, it's also, girls as well. But young people that need a shot at life that maybe they didn't have just growing up, on their own and with the situation that they had. And so many people that went through the Boys Town system still like work for Boys Town. They were so moved and so affected by their experience and so transformed by it that they wanted to give back themselves to the system that took care of them and really gave them hope, you know?
Jonathan, I want to give folks a little taste of what they'll be seeing in Heart of a Servant, the Father Flanagan story. Take a look.
Father Flanagan foresaw the widespread devastation the war would leave in its wake. particularly the impact it would have on children and families. Anticipating these needs, he wrote a letter to an old friend to see what could be done. My dear Mr. President, when the war is won on the battlefields, there will literally be millions of orphan children left homeless, destitute, and abandoned. There will be many whose fathers will not return and whose mothers will have been victims of atrocities. If these children are neglected, they will be easy prey to temptation and crime. If, however, they are properly cared for, they will become the most able leaders in the peaceful rehabilitation of their countries. If you feel, Mr. President, that my knowledge of this problem, gained through many years of actual experience, can be effectively applied, my humble services are yours to command at any time.
Our viewers may remember the hit film from 1938, Boys Town, starring Spencer Tracy and Mickey Rooney. Tracy won the Oscar that year in 1939 for playing Father Flanagan. Father Flanagan famously said, Jonathan, that there is no such thing as a bad boy. How did he live that philosophy on a day-to-day basis?
He poured into these children. He poured into this town, this life, this society that he created. And they, in turn, gave everything they had to Father Flanagan. In fact, when many of them went off to fight during the Second World War, the majority of them named Father Flanagan, those who went to Boys Town, of course, as their next of kin, and also he was voted America's number one war dad. And so, I mean, the proof was in the lives that they lived, the lives of service, the lives of activism, the lives of compassion and love, and what they went on to accomplish, not just as children that other people would have just written off, but as adults, was just extraordinary.
Father Flanagan's cause for canonization has now been opened, and the vice postulator for the beatification is himself a Boys Town alum. There are other Americans in competition, as you know. The first native-born American saint is a hotly contested title. You've got Venerable Fulton Sheen, the first male saint, rather, American male saint. You've got Fulton Sheen. You've got Pierre Toussaint. You've got a whole slew of people. Why do you think Father Flanagan should be a saint, and what's the status of the cause?
He currently is a servant of God, and he was essentially a living saint. Everything that he did, what he sacrificed physically, mentally, spiritually, on behalf of these kids, the fact that he went up against the Ku Klux Klan fearlessly, and put himself always second to the children that he cared for, just was a testament to his cause. And, for instance, you go to Japan and their entire child welfare system is based on the structures that Father Flanagan put in place. In Austria, there are streets named after schools named after him, they know very well how much of a legacy that he left all over the world, really, because he was sent to these places to try to really implement the rules that he came up with, the structures that he came up with in America for Boys Town, and start implementing them all over the world where these kids were in need of guidance and tutelage and just a second chance.
Jonathan, finally, why did you labor over this project? What did you hope viewers would take from Heart of a Servant, this new documentary coming to theaters on October 8th?
My goal was to bring Father Flanagan's story into the world, to let people know how accessible his story is even today, how relevant and how needed it is. You know, when we're in a time where, you know, we need somebody that is fighting for the poorest and the most impoverished, the most vulnerable. Children are the most vulnerable members of society, and that hasn't changed. That'll never change. They will always be the most vulnerable of society, and we need someone to champion for them. And Father Flanagan was that man.
Jonathan Rumi, as always, thank you for being here. Heart of a Servant, the Father Flanagan story, narrated by Jonathan Rumi, and in theaters for one night only, Tuesday, October 8th, from Fathom Events. For movie times and tickets, go to fatherflanaganfilm.com. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Raymond.
He's a stand-up comic, a star of countless classic comedy movies, and former writer and Emmy-nominated cast member on Saturday Night Live. He's also become a crusader for free speech and the First Amendment. And he's got a fascinating new memoir that touches on that very subject. You Can Do It. Speak Your Mind, America. It's available now everywhere. Now, I sat down with him in Washington, D.C., and we went for about 45 minutes. And I hate breaking promises to you, because I promised you this full interview, and we recorded it. And for whatever reason, there was some technical glitch, and the entire interview has been vaporized. So I don't have the full interview for you. All I have is the 16 minutes that we aired a few weeks ago, where Rob talks about his Catholic faith. So I wish I could bring you the whole thing. We'll get a full interview with Rob in the future, but for the meantime, here's a bit of my interview with Rob Schneider. You Can Do It opens with the most unbelievable intro I think I may have ever read.
And I've read
a lot of intros. And here's what it touches on. Filipino slurs, assorted profanities, gambling with Norm MacDonald, and Father Chad Ripperger. How do you put all that together, Rob?
I'm a new Catholic, so I'm coming at this in a as an older gentleman who also has had a wonderful gift of these beautiful children. And I have to be the guardian, and to be parents, not friends, but parents to these beautiful kids. And you want to raise them in something that is meaningful. And the thing that constantly is that you will hear about, like whether it's the former Soviet Union, whether it's North Korea, or whether it's China, is that godless tyranny, there is a hopelessness. And I will say that. There is a sadness and an emptiness that children now are feeling, that these young Generation Z has, and it is because of a godless society. So there is a hopelessness in that, and I really, really feel that if they could come closer to God and realize this great gift, and to be the reflection that God calls us to be, His God's reflection on us.
Well, somewhere in You Can Do It, I wrote this down the other night when I was reading the book. This is all a test for us, you write.
Yeah.
Unlike other belief systems and religions, say cancel culture, for example, that call upon their believers to hate and destroy their enemies, ours calls upon us to love our enemies. How is all of this a test, Rob?
It's the same reason that God put the apple in Eden, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, he could have made it just very easy. He could come down and show his hand right now.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't be loving. What's loving is to push your kids to not just watch TV and videos, and you can give them pizza all day. But if you love your children like God loves us, he wants to challenge us. He wants us to bring out our best, and he wants us to come to him of our own volition. And I think these tests are very loving. There's no accident that as soon as our kids are old enough, I don't know if we educate them correctly, but we push them to do it so that they can be challenged, and that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's the most beautiful gift you can give.
Tell me about this revival of faith. I mean, I know your dad was Jewish, your mother was Filipina.
Yeah, so my mother was Catholic. So when I went to the old Bill Maher joke, when I went to confession, I bring my attorney. Father, this is Mr. Cohen. He'll be answering all our questions. It was always there. I mean, Jesus only lets you go so far before he comes like, aha, okay, right, that's enough.
I'm coming.
Yeah. And I do feel like you have anytime there is as we all sense it now, there's a rise in evil in the world. Mm-hmm. It's not going to win, but it's being allowed to happen now, and it's purposeful. And it is we are some of the challenges that we're facing challenges in the family, We're facing challenges in the schools that our kids go to. We're facing challenges by our leaders. And how do we rise to that? And how do we bring out our best? How do we protect our children? Mm-hmm. And how do we now, you know, congratulations, our nation's having problems. Now we can really decide what kind of nation we want, what kind of family we want, community, and what do we want to, how do we want to reflect God's love to the world and to each other?
You say in the book that there was an organized evil, I imagine connected in some way to the COVID shutdowns and the mandates, but an organized evil you talk about that presaged this conversion. What was that organized evil? What did it look like?
It is a power authoritarian grab, and like all power grabs, they become corrupt. And so what happened was, it was a continuation of trying to get more and more. And it's whether it's the pharmaceutical companies buying off every Republican, every Democrat in Congress, not just the federal level, but the state level. You really feel there is a crunch on freedom and that individual liberty. And it's evil. And I would say that, like, for you have to call that evil by its name. It is demonic. It is the lies. And the lies are coming. And it's a rise in evil. And as M. Scott Peck said to me many, many years ago, the great author of The Road Less Traveled, he said, if the devil exists, he's saying, don't make waves. Just don't become part of this. And I think it behooves us, and it asks us and it demands us right now to make waves, to stand up for what's right. And this is a great opportunity that we have. So along with this Marxist communism, and communism is really just an attack on Christianity. Yep. That's what Karl Marx did. This was an assault on it, and he did group these ideas to go after. And what we're seeing now is a real attack on the family unit. There's an attack on mothers, fathers, women, children. And this is evil, and we have to call this what it is, and we need to be, it's a spiritual warfare that we're in. And if we don't acknowledge that, we're not going to be able to fight it sufficiently.
In your parish of Our Lady of Perpetual Help, you went to convert classes before. I mean, you didn't just come back to, you actually went through the process.
I was the oldest by 47 years of the in the class, and it's with my daughter, and it was beautiful. And the idea of coming at it from a new Catholic is really is beautiful, because, you know, like the priest was talking about last week at Mass, the idea of his followers, for Jesus's followers, were saying, like, they're, you know, they were weirded out by this idea of, this is my flesh,
right.
this is my blood. So this is something that, like, a lot of Catholics take for granted. But, like, well, this is just, no, but this isn't, can you imagine his followers say, this is, take this in memory of me.
Yeah.
This is my blood. And some of them go, like, I don't know, that's a little weird. So I really feel that these ideas and this stuff is fresh, and it really, and it's beautiful. And what it talks about is the sacrifice and love of this. And a beautiful thing that my father pastor said to me, which just made me tear up. He said, talking about salvation and talking about the sacrifice and what we need to sacrifice now, because speaking up and talking and protecting our families and our nation is important now. And he talked about the sacrifice of Jesus, and he said, even the cold breeze that the baby Jesus felt the night he was born is enough suffering for your salvation. And I was like, wow, how beautiful is that? How much more so? What does it cost to risk your career or potential job when you think about what we need to protect for our children? And our children are under attack now.
Yeah.
And the society demands that we stand up and be courageous.
I saw you talking to our pal Tucker recently about the power of the rosary. Is this a new devotion?
I need this.
Rosary.
I need this. This was just given to me.
Look at that, with the St. Benedict medal and all.
Yes.
Was this a devotion? Did your mother pray the rosary? Did your family pray the
rosary? No, my mother didn't, but my Patricia and I did it the other night. And when it was a lot of worldly pressure and tension, and it all dissipated so powerfully. The idea, because people talk about prayer, like, oh, you got a prayer, and we get our prayers, but it's powerful.
Yeah.
I felt the prayers of many people, but specifically when you pray with another person, someone that you love, and the greatest gift that Jesus has given to me is my beautiful wife, Patricia, and those gorgeous kids. And we prayed together, and I felt a sense of peace for days. Mm. I mean, for the next day. And you have to know that is really powerful. And I never really felt that before.
Will this refound faith at all change the stand-up act? I've
yes.
seen your stand-up act.
Yes.
It's a little, look.
I know.
It's closer to Carlin than, you know, Mother Teresa.
It is. I talked to my priest about it, and, you know, and I said, you know, Father, you know, I have a stand-up act, and it's pretty dirty. He said, well, you may have to think about it. You know, I'll give an Irish voice just because it sounds better.
Yeah, yeah.
Routine. He said, well, you may have to think about that, young man. You know, and I said, you know, do the right thing. He said, but it's pretty funny. Well, yeah, but you're either serving the Lord or you're serving the world. And I said, yeah, you know the right choice to make. I said, you're right. I said, I don't know if I'll be able to give as much money to the church. And he said, you got to make the people laugh, Robbie. You've got to make them laugh, Robbie. If you don't, that's your gift.
Well, if you're asking my opinion, Rob, you can do it.
Oh, thank
you.
You
can do it. But
right.
No, look, I think it's a comedy club. People, there's a certain segment of the audience that is going to expect some edge.
I am changing it. Thank you. I am changing it, and I am.
You
I
are.
Do have to make an adaptation, but at the same time, I think that it's important to, and that's the thing about Catholicism now, and why the outreach and why there's such growth right now,
mm-hmm.
is because we have to reach out to everyone.
Yeah.
We need to bring people to the church, and for whatever reason is happening now, I don't know why I'm been thrust into this place, but I said turn over to God whatever I'm supposed to do, then please let me know and it's important to reach out and bring people to the faith.
Well, and let's talk about the role of the comedian in that. I mean, obviously, priests have his role, laymen have their role. What's the role of the comedian in society today? You spend a lot of time, and you can do it, talking about that critical role. And I've said it for years, the last truth tellers left are comedians right now.
Well, I would say just Christianity was a subversive underground thing, mm-hmm. where it's like, hey, there's this
the way.
Yeah. did you know about this? And I remember the first time I was exposed to Christianity was in born again Christianity when I was 13. And I remember being around these people go, why are these people so happy? Mm-hmm. What do they got? What's happening with them? Mm-hmm. That was an interest in it. What stand-up and what comedy has the ability to do in the same way, to subvert people through laughter, to bring them to a point of reason, to a point of rationale, and a point of forgiveness. And I didn't realize that last part until recently. Mm. And when I wrote this book, a lot of it was still very angry about, and I have to be careful about that, because the real tenet is forgiveness. And forgiveness isn't just for the other person, it's for yourself. Mm. You have to let go, and you have to. And I didn't understand the concept, just like I didn't understand the concept of how powerful prayer was. I didn't understand the concept of turning it over to God. I just thought these things are just said. I didn't realize the power behind it. It liberates you, and I think that good laughter, jokes can liberate people.
But there became a point. Look, you've got Richard Pryor, and you've got Carlin, and you've got all these great, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock. Yourself.
Soothsayers.
Well, people were looking, you mentioned it, in the rearview mirror of the culture.
Yeah.
So that you're kind of casting back on the people what they're living through. And yeah, they're laughing at it, but they're also internalizing it in a different way. But
yes.
When did comedians start throwing rocks, not at the powerful, but at the people?
What happens is there is this idea that somehow they're, and the Democratic Party is not alone in this, but the idea that somehow they are the trodden upon, that they are the ones in power. And so they're the ones that are really attacking the people, and they're attacking freedom. And that is something that it's an inverse, and it is a critical error on their part. And if they lose the election, it'll be because of that. So the idea was, and the attack on during COVID was to attack small businesses, and it was for real authoritarian. You have to say these are bad people.
Mm.
When Gavin Newsom closes churches and keeps open strip clubs and weed stores and liquor stores, but closes the church, at that point you have to go, thank you for being so openly honest and hostile towards God and towards people, that you would take away this solace that people needed at that terrible time. The thing about Satan, the thing about the devil, And the thing about evil is it, at its core, it has to expose itself. And it has to. And so you see it and you go, okay, well, that's evil.
Right.
So it makes it more obvious. And in these times, which I think we have a rise of evil, and it's not going to go away anytime soon, just like it happened 100 years ago in Europe. And it's and the but the I will say this, the hope for the world is the United States. And that's why it's important that we've got to draw the line here, because there will be no Marshall Plan for the United States. There's no Marines from some other country going to land here. There will be no food drop. This is it. This is the final stand, not just for the United States, but for the world, for freedom. So whether problems we have, whatever, we cannot let this current administration continue to undermine us and make it more dangerous here, so that we can allow these this Marxist regime to take over. And believe me, that's a real threat. I don't think it'll win.
You know what? I was stunned to read that you almost left stand-up, or you weren't going to go back to it. And then you spoke to Chris Rock.
Chris Rock was, because Adam Sandler was always telling me to do it. But I always, he loves me, and he's my brother, and he's just like, he's worried about me financially. He said, no, you should go back at that. You know, you mean, you know. But when Chris Rock says, you know, he told me, he said, you could be the best at this. And I said, oh, yeah, but I don't even, thank you, but I don't even know what I would talk about. And he said, just talk about what you talk to me every morning. So he's one of those wonderful, real liberals who supports freedom, supports ideas, and supports this, and has a great faith for what this country offers, which is opportunity. And and he really is one of the masters. He's the guy who changed modern comedy. So I really took him seriously. And I said, I don't know if I could do it. And then he came up to me and he nudged me. He knew how I engaged it. You know what I think? I said, what? I think you don't like money. I went like, all right. So there's money. He said, yeah, there's money. What are you, stupid? What are you? And so thank you, Chris, for that. And I will say, it's reopened my career, and it's opened my eyes, and it's got me to meet many people to make me realize that, like, you know, the problem of New York and Los Angeles is you can get caught in your own echo chamber, and you don't realize the ramifications for the, you know, the garbage that's cranked out in the liberal media that doesn't represent most of this country and doesn't help most of the country.
You Can Do It, Speak Your Mind, America, by Rob Schneider, is available now at bookstores everywhere and online. And we're going to catch up with him in the days ahead. That's all the time for now. Be sure to tune in next week for another update on the Synod and my exclusive interview with Coach Joe Kennedy and the movie based on his life, The Fight for Religious Liberty, Average Joe. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.